Locked On Heat is a daily podcast covering the Miami Heat. We will be here every weekday from now until the end of the season. Support the show by subscribing on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Thank you.
You are Locked On Heat, your daily Miami Heat podcast. Part of the Locked On Podcast Network. Your team every day.
Hello and welcome to a crossover episode of Locked On Heat and Locked On Knicks. I'm Wes Goldberg here with David Ramil, also of Locked On Heat, and Jared Dubin of Locked On Knicks.
Hey guys.
How you doing?
I'm great. It's a not so nice day here in New York City, but it's a good day to record a podcast, that means.
Always a good day to record a podcast.
That's true, but when it's just gross and nasty out, what is it, just raining right now, or...?
It's not raining, it's just kind of gross out.
Perfect. So you gave us a call and now we're recording a podcast. This is perfect.
It's what I like to do on gross days.
Talk to us. So we've been doing a few crossover episodes the last couple weeks, but this one, we want to specifically talk about two of the more promising young players in the NBA, Kristaps Porzingis of the Knicks and Justice Winslow, obviously, the Heat. Let's just start with Kristaps Porzingis. After a really strong rookie season, Jared, he had this unicorn tag on and everything. Is this new future big? How much of that do you think is going to play a factor in how the Knicks play basketball?
That's the balancing act that I think is kind of really important to the season. Because they do have two ball dominant, scoring-oriented offensive players, obviously, in Carmelo and Derrick Rose, and figuring out where Kristaps fits in that hierarchy, at least during the time that Rose is healthy, because he's going to miss some games, figuring out where Kristaps fits, whether he's the number two option or the number three option, that's going to be a real key to whether or not the Knicks are a good offense, I think, because... there are ways that they can use him in conjunction with those two guys that should help all of them. And then there are scenarios where it's just like Carmelo and Rose taking turns and Kristaps is relegated to, you know, not just the number three option, but like a true backseat to two guys who control everything. And that's not good for them, I don't think.
Is that a concern that maybe... I know, listening to you talking to other people on the crossover podcast, I know that you thought that he was either going to take a small step back at the worst, but that he's likely to take a big step forward as far as his overall development. But knowing that the roster has changed dramatically from one season to the next, are you worried at all that his development will be stunted or that he'll, you know, consider to be cast in a complimentary role that might not suit him?
I'm a little bit worried about that, not too much, just because he's so good and such a, you know, magnetic presence for the ball because of all the different things he can do on the court. It is a little worrisome. You know, a lot of people are projecting all this improvement onto him because of the presence of Derrick Rose. But if you look at the SportView numbers and other numbers, Rose is not really a guy that looks for his screener all that much when he's coming around pick and rolls. And even if he does, you know, he's going to take touches that might have been Kristaps's. He's going to take those away. A little bit, like I would imagine, he's going to touch the ball slightly less. He may not get the ball in quite as good of positions. But, you know, to me, the more likely scenario, like, he's just so talented and he does so many things to go get the ball himself with crashing the offensive boards or making plays on defense. And he's going to be playing more minutes anyway. That even if he's not quite as productive on a per-minute basis as he was last year, he's going to look just as, if not more, productive because he's going to be out there more. Mm-hmm. So I'm not necessarily worried about the perception so much as, like, you know, where he falls within that hierarchy based on the two guys around him. But the worries are very small because he's so good. Like, right. Yes, I did say there is a small chance that he doesn't get better this year. That's just because, you know, if you look at the history of the NBA, improvement isn't always linear. Like, you think guys are always going to get better and it's just up, 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 and then down, 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 down. It doesn't always work like that. Like, sometimes it's fits and starts. Like, I don't imagine that he will be one of those guys, but I just wanted to raise the possibility so that it's not totally unexpected, if that makes sense.
The thing that stood out to me
about Kristaps' rookie year is that he's just so naturally gifted at basketball. Like, there's not, like, I don't like comparing all white European guys to white European guys, but he really is like a younger Dirk, where it's just like, you know, the moment he hits the NBA, it's just like, okay, this guy is just, he's a basketball player. This guy just plays basketball. And he, as far as his physical limitations, there's not much of him, if anything. You know, he's got a smooth stride. He's ridiculously tall. Like, what's he listed at? 7 feet now? He's probably 7 feet.
He's listed as 7'3".
He's 7'6", like, I swear. Like,
yeah,
that guy's huge.
He's a giant human, but he does move really well. And that's something that, you know, I wrote about towards the end of the season, where, you know, big guys obviously are at a very high risk for injury. But the fact that he moves so smoothly, I think, works in his favor in that sense, you know, as opposed to maybe some other guys that are his size that sort of have choppier movements. He's not really like that. You know, it's not quite Karl Towns, who moves like he's like 6'3",
right.
But Kristaps does not move like a 7'3" man. And that's, I think, really good for him too.
I think I've told this story on the podcast before, but when David and I were both at Summer League in Orlando, and
I'm glad you brought it up.
I walked by Kristaps Porzingis in the hallway, and he's surrounded by a bunch of reporters. And so I could see, like, you know, his belly button up, because all the other, that's basically where the reporters reached, was just basically to his waist. And I distinctly remember looking down to see if he was standing on top of something. Like, he must have been, like, on a platform or, like, a box or something. Like, was there a stage there in the middle of the hallway? I looked down. It was just his shoes. It was just a pair of Nikes. And I was like, there's no way this guy is that tall.
I thought you were going to bring up Phil Jackson busting out of, like, a hallway closet or something like that. It was, like, a very small room.
It was a hidden room. It looked like wallpaper. There was not even a doorknob. It was just, like, a hidden room. Yeah.
Yeah, Phil Jackson comes out of nowhere. You know, his mobility is limited somewhat, but he comes out of nowhere just as Kristaps is walking down this hallway in Orlando's practice center, and he immediately clings on to Porzingis and starts busting his chops about some, and these are his words, a black girl that he was talking to on a street somewhere, and that he saw this, and he starts busting his chops about it. It was one of the most, you know, off-color, hilarious moments that you catch in Summer League.
Yeah, he's really big. Like, he does a lot of his post-game interviews in the Garden sitting down in a chair. And he's just as tall as, like, the tallest reporter when he does that. It's sort of emasculating. He's so big. Like, it makes us feel like small men.
just little Lego men walking around his world. I did want to ask about Kristaps as far as, do you think the addition of Joakim Noah is going to help him, or do you think, and him being almost bracketed in place by a true center like Joakim Noah and a true small forward like Carmelo Anthony, is that going to help him, or do you think that this Knicks roster isn't really built to help Kristaps?
I think that it will help in some ways and hurt in others. You know, last year, his rebounding was much better when he had Robin Lopez on the court with him. And I think that that's something that will likely continue with Noah this season. I think Noah will help him in sort of picking up the intricacies of defense, you know, in the same way that Robin Lopez helped him out with rim protection last season. I think Noah can help him out with, you know, moving your feet with perimeter defense and guarding those in-between spaces and pick and rolls that Noah is long been one of the best in the league at doing. You know, and in that sense, it will help him, but it will hurt because it will take away from his time playing center, which, you know, for the majority of his career, I think is where he should be. You know, you want to ideally get him to where he's the full-time center, I think, within a couple of years, just because he has the potential to really change games much more from that position than he does as a power forward. And, you know, if Noah's making $17, $18 million a year and spending obviously all of his time at that spot, then it takes away from how often Kristaps can be there. So, you know, it's a little bit of a push and pull in terms of how much it helps or doesn't.
One more question about Kristaps, and I know you wanted to bring up Justice Winslow for a little bit there, but, you know, I'm curious, you know, about how he's able to handle the New York media so well. And obviously there's a certain element of that whenever any player achieves any kind of fame in New York and everything that entails. But he seems like, you know, despite, you know, or whatever, however you want to phrase it, you know, perhaps not being necessarily as used to it being from Europe and everything else, he seems almost a gifted natural at being able to accept how he's been embraced, et cetera. And obviously it wasn't necessarily a smooth transition. You know, there was some issues there when he was originally drafted, and, you know, he's gone past those because he's just proven himself to be open and willing to talk to media. And obviously the strength of his game overall has helped as well. I mean, can you kind of just like explain that whole, you know, how he fits in there, how he's become a celebrity necessarily in New York?
Yeah, I mean, well, first of all, it helps that he played really well and right away. If he had struggled out of the gate, things might have been different, but I don't think they would have been that different because he's just a genuinely, like, really good dude and a really smart person, too, which helps because you can tell that he sort of very carefully considers questions and tries to answer them in a way that makes sense rather than just giving soundbite cliches all the time. You know, he does resort to that sometimes, like sort of like Jeter style, where he'll give an answer that seems like it says a lot, but it's actually just a bunch of cliches back to back to back. But when he gets a question that, you know, is interesting and demands an interesting answer, he thinks about it and he gives an interesting answer, which is different than the way some guys have handled New York. And I think that the people that cover him notice that and appreciate that. And, you know, because he does that, he's sort of endeared himself to the people that are covering him every day, which obviously helps endear him to the people that are reading about him every day. But, you know, his personality is so magnetic anyway that I think people would be drawn to him even if writers were, you know, just lukewarm toward him and not, you know, head over heels thinking he's a great guy.
Okay. Interesting.
So 5 years from now, I think Kristaps Porzingis is, I think you're right that he's going to be best at center. The way that the league is trending, it's only going to keep trending that way probably. And if you look at guys like Karl-Anthony Towns and all the, and even Anthony Davis, these fives who can stretch the floor and do non-five things, or you can really build a team around that. I don't know if the Knicks are built that way now, but there's so many veterans on that team that, you know, 5-6 years from now and Kristaps is there and these guys aren't, like, who I'm curious about where you see just overall, like, league trends. Like, what do you think, like, 5-6 years from now those guys will be used like, and who do you now pair along with Kristaps Porzingis? I guess, like, what I'm trying to ask is, like, who would be a good player if Kristaps is playing center? Who do you need at power forward to kind of bring out the best in Kristaps Porzingis?
I think the best part about his skill set is that you can really put any kind of player next to him once he gains, you know, the physicality to play center. You know, because he's such a good shooter and already such a good rim protector, and showed last year that he has the capability on occasion to switch out on perimeter players in pick and roll situations, that you really can put basically any kind of power forward next to him and it should work, because you shouldn't have spacing problems no matter what, because, you know, if it's a shooter, then great, you have even more shooting. If it's a non-shooter, he's pulling one of the two big men out of the paint because of his ability to shoot anyway. You know, if you have a guy who is a great rim protector but can't necessarily cover in space, well, then you have Kristaps to cover in space. If you have a guy who's not a great rim protector but can defend, you know, on the block or in space, well, you have Kristaps to guard the rim. You know, that's what makes him such a special player and why I think that getting him to that center spot is so important for the Knicks and their future, because it just opens up so many different ways that you can build your team.
his versatility is similar to, I think, Justice Winslow, where Porzingis can play the four, but with the way that the league is going, you know, he's probably best off at five. I think with the way the league is going, Justice is, you know, he seems like a natural small forward, but I also think, you know, 3-4 years down the line, he might be best used as a power forward type, where, because he can defend big guys, but he can also come out and defend, you know, a James Harden even. And I think that's for Winslow, there's a similar value in his versatility as there is with Kristaps, right?
Oh, I definitely think so. You know, to me, it seems like he could sort of be like a, almost like, you know, when the Heat had LeBron playing quote unquote the four and Battier next to him, mm-hmm. where, you know, Battier was the four on defense and the three on offense. Winslow could be sort of the same way, but like on steroids, because he can do, you know, a few more things than Battier could. It seems like that would be sort of the ideal role for him. You know, he can play the four on offense, you know, because he's not a great shooter, but he can grab rebounds and he can pass a little bit and he knows how to cut and can set screens and, you know, find the in-between spaces. And then on defense, you know, he can guard fours, yeah, but he's also, you know, a perimeter stopper in the mold of some of the best perimeter defenders in the league. And, you know, very similar to Kristaps, like you said, it opens up so many different ways that not only you can construct lineups, but build your team.
That probably would have been a little bit more likely, you know, had Chris Bosh not been able to play this season. And while we're glad that he's available, you know, we would have been curious to see if Eric Spoelstra could have played, you know, with a little bit more versatility, or with, you know, using Winslow's versatility a little bit more effectively. But you've resigned, you know, Hassan Whiteside, and Chris Bosh seems likely to come back at the power forward position. And so it's more than likely that Winslow is going to be at least as a starter stuck at small forward. Although, I mean, obviously you can switch him around defensively, and Bosh has proven throughout his career that he can guard players along the perimeter and he can be effective in that way. But, you know, assuming, you know, that Bosh might be in and out of the lineups on some occasions, you know, Wes and I have discussed on a number of occasions that we think Derek Williams would be the natural to start in Miami and take over there. And I know that's a significant drop off from a guy as talented as Chris Bosh to Derek Williams, but he did play last season with New York, and we were wondering if maybe you can explain how he fit there or didn't fit there, and what we might be able to expect from him if he takes over that power forward position from Bosh.
Yeah, I think you can expect him to be sort of similar to what he was in New York, where there are games where he's very good and games where he is very not. And those come seemingly at random and have almost nothing to do with what happened the game before. And is almost entirely dependent on whether his forays to the rim turn out well, because he's not necessarily a good shooter and he doesn't really bring all that much to the table defensively, despite his athleticism. So, you know, it's got its ups and downs starting him at that spot. You know, it's better for him than being at the three, because again, that shot is not great. But, I mean, are you screwed if you have to start him? No. Is it an ideal situation? Also, no. You know? So it's you can make do with it, and if you have enough around him, you can be okay. But, I mean, I don't think he started at all for the Knicks last year, and it's really not ideal at all if he has to start for the Heat.
Yeah, he did. He didn't. We checked that out, actually, before jumping on board, and no, unfortunately, he didn't. And we were kind of curious, because I don't think we remember him. He came off the bench. Was he just playing alongside Carmelo in most lineups with Carmelo at the four? Or was it kind of like what you were describing with Bosh and Battier, where they were kind of switching off offensively, defensively, as far as what their respective roles were on the court?
Yeah, I mean, he played more, I think, with Lance Thomas than with Carmelo. You know, there were times when he was on the court with Carmelo, but for the most part, Williams was a bench guy and played with bench units, and that's sort of the way it went. And they were sort of interchangeable as 3-4s, and that's how they worked it out. because, you know, Williams not a great shooter, not necessarily equipped to guard the best perimeter guy, but also not necessarily equipped to guard low post guys. So Thomas would take the tougher forward matchup between the two of them, and they would sort of, you know, both be hybrid forwards, as opposed to one being the small forward and one being the power
right.
forward.
Right.
I'm curious, from, I guess, both of you, the way that this has been a famously loaded draft, right? The 2015 NBA draft that we're talking about. Originally, the New York Knicks were in a lot of mock drafts were slotted to take Justice Winslow.
Yep.
At four.
Is that what I should disclose? Yeah. Winslow was my favorite player in the draft. I love him.
Why is that?
You know, talking about coming into the draft, that was the guy that, you know, other than Karl Towns, who I knew wasn't getting to the Knicks at four, Winslow to me was the guy that was just perfect. You know, I thought that you draft him, you can put him next to Carmelo. Winslow is the four on offense and the three on defense. Again, turn him into that sort of like hybrid Battier role. And it would have been perfect. I love him so much. So I just wanted to throw that out there.
I think that Winslow is going to be, we throw out so many comparisons with Winslow, like Kawhi Leonard is a big one. Pat Riley compared him to Draymond Green after the draft. Other guys like Jimmy Butler and Paul George and these guys have been thrown around a little bit. I think that he's going to be somewhere in between maybe Kawhi Leonard and Draymond Green. I don't know if he's going to be necessarily as gifted offensively as either of those guys, but maybe just as far as the way he's used, you know, some guy that...
Yeah, when I say the hybrid Battier role, I'm not talking about skill level. Like, I think he's better than that.
Yeah.
I'm just talking about, you know, the way he's used, just to clarify.
Yeah, I think I think I agree with you, and I think that's maybe what I'm getting at with, like, this in-between, like, Kawhi, Draymond. Because Draymond Green played, like, obviously he could play center, he could play small forward, he can guard anybody on the floor, 1-5, and Kawhi is just so disruptive on defense. I think that maybe if Winslow's, like, best-case scenario might be being as disruptive as Kawhi Leonard is defensively, but able to do that from different positions, maybe like Draymond Green is. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think that makes sense. I don't know if he ever necessarily achieves that quite that peak.
Yeah.
But in the absolute best case scenario, I think that makes sense. I don't know if he'd ever quite be as involved offensively as either one of them, just because his skill set lends itself more, I think, to a supplementary role offensively than either of theirs. You know, starting with the fact that he's not a very good shooter, and he's a pretty good passer, but not a great passer like Draymond is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, obviously he could develop those skills more, but I do think you might be better off with him in a supplemental role on offense. And to me, that's okay. Like, he's such a good defender that even being an average offensive player makes him a significantly above average player overall. And if he becomes an above average offensive player, he's even better than that.
Well, we've seen from coaches over the summer is that they actually project Winslow to be much more of a playmaker facilitator, and it's a role that he's going to have to grow into, but it's one that's available now because of the loss of Dwayne Wade. Do you project him being able to fill those rather sizable shoes? And I mean, I know that we're going to be looking to a lot of different players available to create offense. You know, the role that Dwayne Wade was filling for so many years here in Miami, but you know, obviously Goran Dragic is going to be able to take up a bigger load. You know, whoever starts at the shooting guard position, either Josh Richardson once he comes back from injury, or Deion Waiters, or one of those. But yeah, obviously Winslow is going to be looked at as somebody who can carry the load a little bit offensively. Do you project him being able to fill that a little bit?
Yeah, I feel like it's got to be a burden sharing situation where, you know, he's not taking over all of Wade's responsibility with the ball in his hands. You know, that's too much. But giving him, you know, more on-ball responsibility than he had last year is beneficial not just for his development, but for the team too. You know, spread things out a little bit more, get guys more involved, you have a little bit more flow within the offense, you know, sort of like they had over the second half of last season. You know, not because they didn't have Chris Bosh, but because they were forced to get a little bit more creative with the ball once they didn't have Chris Bosh. I think a similar thing can happen without Wade, especially if they push the ball up the floor. But, you know, I mean, you guys would probably know better than me. Is that something they're going to try to do again, even with Bosh back? Because it did seem like you know, Bosch not being on the court was one of the motivating factors in them playing much faster over the second half of the season.
That's what we've heard anyway. I think, you know, Spoelstra's talked about it, and I think he's reached out to Dragic in Slovenia, and I think what we've seen and what we've heard is that they're looking to play at a much faster pace, and I think the personnel dictates that. I mean, Wade obviously was slowing down the offense considerably, as was Luol Deng. I mean, he did have some spurts there when he slid into Bosch's power forward position where he was able to kind of pick up the pace a little bit. But I think, you know, with a guy like Winslow, with a guy like Richardson, should he, you know, come back from injury at 100%, and even a guy like Whiteside, who they're looking to help push the pace a little bit. That's not something that Whiteside did naturally, but that seems to be what the team is gearing for this season.
Yeah, I think you hit it on the head when you want the ball in Winslow's hands a little bit, you have to defend the guy with the ball. So now all of a sudden guys aren't sagging off of him. People, like a lot of opponents were just sagging off of him, completely ignoring him when he didn't have the ball and he was just kind of standing in the corner. And that really clogged up Miami's spacing. But if Justice Winslow has the ball, you can't just ignore him. You got to play up on him a little bit. And now all of a sudden maybe, you know, a guy like Goran Dragic, who has shown an ability to be a decent outside shooter in the past, but maybe doesn't always have the opportunity to do that. You get him off the ball a little bit. You get guys like Deion Waiters and Josh Richardson off the ball a little bit. Tyler Johnson, same thing. And all of a sudden, maybe you do have an offense that flows a little bit more. And I think at Duke, what stuck out to me with Winslow and why I liked him a lot, why I was so high on him coming out, was, yes, he's a lockdown defender, but I like his ability to handle things in the pick and roll. He showed he was kind of like the Jahlil Okafor, you know, whisperer, so to speak. I always called Wade the Whiteside whisperer, and to me Winslow played that similar role with Jahlil Okafor at Duke, where he was able to get Okafor in really good positions to score under the basket, and I like that. I want to see more of that, and I really like that he's got a quick first step. I really do think he's got a lot of room to develop as a facilitator. I think there's a lot of room between where he's at now and what his ceiling is.
I agree with that. What do you think the likelihood of him hitting that playmaking ceiling is? Because there's obviously a continuum in there where, you know, is it likely that he gets to Draymond Green level facilitator? You know, I think the potential might be there, but the likelihood of him getting there is somewhat low. You know, so what do you think is sort of the most likely scenario in terms of, you know, where he settles in terms of how good of a playmaker he can be?
Yeah, this is what I tell a lot of Heat fans. Like, a lot of people say, okay, what's he need to do to become the next Draymond Green? What's he need to do to become next Kawhi Leonard? And I was like, well, if he doesn't hit, like, those are really large ceilings. Like, those are some of the best players in the NBA, right? Like, those guys are going to go down in history as some of the guys that have changed their positions. But if he's even 70% of what those guys are, that is a huge get for the Miami Heat, you know? And so I think, to me, that's where he's going to be. I think he is going to be a little bit of a different flavor. He might be maybe more traditional in the sense at offensively, where he's not going to be the guy that they're running the offense through a la Draymond Green a lot of times, but he could be that second or third facilitator when Goran Dragic or whoever his point guard that he's going to be playing with needs to get the ball out of his hands. And you could just run maybe a couple different sets for him and do some things there. I think there's a really good chance that he hits that where his ceiling as far as what he's capable of. It's interesting. I think when he was drafted, a lot of the talk was, oh, the Heat are such a perfect fit for Winslow because he can come along slowly. They've got so many veterans in place there. They don't really need him right now. So, you know, all these things that he's so raw at on offense, he can really develop now. But after, with a year under his belt and with Dwayne Wade gone and Joe Johnson and Luol Deng and just his whole roster basically turned over, I think he's in a new but also good situation that he's going to be asked to practice facilitating the ball. And this team doesn't necessarily have high expectations, like realistic expectations, right? They're not going to beat the Cavaliers in the East. So maybe they do have some time to experiment. There's going to be a lot of experimenting going on. I mean, this is the first time Dwayne Wade hasn't been the lead on offense, if not LeBron James, for like the last 13 seasons. So there's going to be a lot of experimenting on offense. I think Winslow's going to be a big part of that. So that's going to be an interesting situation for him to be in.
Yeah, I've got one more question for you guys before we go. So I think most people are largely in agreement that that 2015 draft class, right, at least right now after 1 year, looks like probably the best draft class since that 2003 class, which was not necessarily deep, but had so much firepower at the top with LeBron and Wade and Carmelo and Bosh. So if Karl Towns is the LeBron of the draft class, where do you see Kristaps and Winslow? Like, is Kristaps the Wade or the Carmelo? Is Winslow the Bosh maybe? I think it's a really interesting way to think about it, because Winslow is on Wade's old team and Kristaps is on Carmelo's team. And, you know, obviously this draft class in 2015 looks to be deeper, you know, with more guys that look like they're going to be really high caliber players. But that class has four of the best players of the last, you know, 20 years in it. So I think it's interesting to view these guys through the prism of that class.
Yeah, I don't necessarily see that there's a direct correlation there, because I don't know that anybody in the 2015 class is necessarily going to be able to reach that same kind of mega generational superstar level talent. You know, I mean, Towns, he's a great player, but I mean, do you really expect him to achieve the same kind of individual success as a guy like LeBron? I mean, it's tough to see him in that role, and I don't know that you know, guys like Kristaps or Winslow are necessarily going to fit into the same kind of projection models that you would have, you know, put, you know, Carmelo and Wade as fulfilling throughout the course of their careers. But maybe it'll just be a different revolution where you see, you know, them filling roles more specifically rather than being, you know, superstar level players and just being able to fill out a role particularly well and do multiple things. Maybe be a versatile player, but just doing it at a good level as opposed to a generationally type great level.
I'll play the game.
Just to be clear, I didn't mean that those guys were equivalent
to
LeBron or Wade or Carmelo in terms of how good they are or their potential impact. I just meant like within the class. Like if Towns is the clear best player in the class, and then Carmelo is, you know, and then Kristaps is second or third, like Wade and Carmelo, you know, where does Bosh fall, Winslow fall in that line? Is he Bosh? Is he not quite that fourth best guy, you know, in that kind of sense?
Well, sure. So I think Towns, you're right. I think Kristaps is Wade as the second best player. And then it's really between Carmelo and Chris Bosh. So basically we're talking about the third and fourth best player in the draft. I think this last draft, Karl Anthony Towns and Kristaps Porzingis are like the top two guys. Like these are like this solid, like build your team around these dudes. They're going to be like all-star level players for the next 10 years in the NBA at least, right? And then there's like that whole other tier of D'Angelo Russell, maybe Emmanuel Mudiay, Devin Booker I'd even put in there. And then there's like another tier of like the Jahlil Okafor, Mario Hezonja, Willie Cauley-Stein, Stanley Johnson. I think Winslow's like in that second tier just because, you know, he doesn't really do a lot in the box score necessarily or certainly not on offense, but he's so far along and so good defensively. Like I'd already put him as like one of the top 15 perimeter defenders in the NBA. I think he's that good. I think he's proven that his first season. He's just so far along and developed on defense. I put him in that second tier. If he can be like, you know, the Chris Bosh of the 2003 class where you know, he's one of the best players in that draft. He's just super consistent throughout his career. Maybe not ever really good enough to be the number one option on like a real title contending team, but also one of these guys that's indispensable and allows you to do so many things. And really helps kind of like usher in a lot of different ways to play on that team that and can just kind of be the glue guy who allows the best players, like the number one option and the number two scoring option, to do their thing. I think that's what Winslow is going to be.
Just so long as he doesn't wind up being Darko Milicic, I think that's the most important thing.
I think the other option was he's Kirk Heinrich.
Yeah, I think that second tier of guys in this class is just, it's so big.
Yeah. I don't think, have we had a second tier like that big in a long time? Like we're like just like kind of like
no.
B to B plus level players for like the next 7 to 10 years?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, I'm in agreement that Towns and Porzingis are the clear 1-2, but you look at the rest of the lottery, just looks terrific. I mean, Russell, Okafor, Hezonja, Cauley-Stein, Moutier, Johnson, Kaminsky, Winslow, Turner, Lyles, Booker, Payne. You know, is the worst guy out of that group Kaminsky, who was like a there as a rookie. You know, maybe Payne probably a little bit was not quite as good as him in year one. Hezonja wasn't called on to do much, but everybody obviously has high hopes for him. You know, even guys at the back half of the first round, you know, Justin Anderson looked like a rotation player. Bobby Portis, a rotation player. Rondae Hollis-Jefferson, before he got hurt, looked very good. Larry Nance was a contributor.
Our own Josh Richardson, too.
Josh Richardson as a second rounder. Norman Powell as a second rounder.
Right.
I mean, the whole draft class was so deep in terms of guys that are at least contributors. It's pretty crazy.
Yeah. All right. Well, I think that's all we got for this crossover episode of Locked On Heat, Locked On Knicks. Definitely looking forward to watching the Knicks this season, by the way. I think this it's a really turnover team, but it's going to be really exciting. If they're not good, they'll at least be interesting to watch, right?
Yeah, I mean, the thing that I've been using to describe them on pretty much all of my podcasts is, you know, they're probably the highest variance team in the league. They can swing anywhere from 30 wins to 50 wins. And some of those would be relatively surprising, and some of them would not be surprising at all. And to me, they'll probably fall somewhere very close to the middle of that. But it does feel like a team where pretty much anything can happen.
Well, that's all we got. Subscribe to Locked On Knicks and Locked On Heat, part of the Locked On Podcast Network. Thanks for listening.